This video is sponsored by CuriosityStream. Watch thousands of great documentaries and the early, ad-free, and extended version of videos like this one on Nebula for just $15 a year. 2017 was an especially turbulent year for North Korea, even by its already aggressive standards. In February, Kim Jong-un's older half-brother Kim Jong-nam was assassinated in Malaysia. During the summer, it accomplished its long-awaited nuclear goal of firing an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching the US mainland. With this new firepower, it threatened to attack the American territory Guam, which the US countered with its own threat of war. The UN Security Council passed more severe sanctions, and the US re-added North Korea to its state sponsors of terrorism list, joining Iran, Sudan, and Syria, 9 years after being removed. Then, in early 2018, tensions began de-escalating. The world sighed a deep breath of relief as North Korea agreed to send athletes to the South Korean Winter Olympic Games, one of a series of actions intended to signal its goodwill. And although this cycle of rising tensions, followed by diplomatic charm, was both familiar and expected, there was real hope that, this time, because North Korea had finally achieved its nuclear security guarantee, it would genuinely be motivated to make and stick to a deal. Kim Jong-un personally invited Donald Trump to a meeting. Then-director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, secretly flew to Pyongyang for preliminary arrangements. And after several near cancellations, both sides agreed to a summit. This would be the first ever meeting between a sitting American and North Korean leader. The decision to meet, however, was only the first in a long chain of private negotiations which would take place in the weeks leading up to the event and would significantly impact its outcome. One such important detail was the location of this historic meeting, which, in many ways, would set the tone of everything to come. Initially, 5 places were rumored to be in consideration. US officials mentioned Vietnam, Thailand, Switzerland, Sweden, and Singapore specifically. At first glance, all of these choices seemed like strong candidates, and the case could easily be made for each of them. Sweden, for example, was the first Western nation to establish an embassy in Pyongyang, who it has maintained unusually strong diplomatic ties with. The US, which does not have an embassy in North Korea, frequently works with and through the Swedish embassy acting as an intermediary. Switzerland, where Kim Jong-un received his childhood education, was also a prime contender. Europe, however, had a natural disadvantage in that it's simply too far. Between taking office and that point in time, Kim had visited only 2 countries, China and South Korea, on 3 trips, during which he was, at most, only 700 kilometers or 400 miles from his home country. Another option, Mongolia, was within reach of Kim Jong-un's state plane or armored train, but lacked the infrastructure necessary to confidently guarantee a smooth-running event. Most importantly, though, the choice of location could not be seen as a concession by either side. Indeed, even holding the event would already be perceived by some as legitimizing the rule of Kim Jong-un. Therefore, the US side would likely not agree to Pyongyang, Beijing, or Russia. The search was narrowed between either near the joint security area on the demilitarized zone, or Singapore, the latter of which ticked all the boxes and then some, and was finally agreed upon. Strangely, the small island city-state is considered friendly territory by both sides, and would even be approved of by other interested parties like China, Russia, and Japan. This, on its own, is remarkable, that a nearby Asian country would have no direct stake or interest in the dispute, beyond a peaceful resolution. Even more so that a country in the region would have strong diplomatic relations with both North Korea and the United States simultaneously. Singapore hosts a North Korean embassy, traded a small number of goods with Pyongyang before sanctions were tightened, and, amazingly, allowed North Korean passport holders visa-free entry until 2016. Practically speaking, it could also guarantee a summit without interruptions. Protests are allowed without police permission only in a single area of one public park, called the Speaker's Corner. A Kim Jong-un impersonator, in fact, was detained and questioned after arriving from Australia. These same legal features, which lead some visitors to call Singapore boring, were precisely what made it so attractive despite being relatively far for Kim, and the event going incredibly smoothly. On June 10th at 8:20 p.m., Air Force One landed at the jointly operated US and Singapore Air Force Paya Lebar Air Base. Kim, on the other hand, arrived earlier that afternoon at Singapore's main international airport, before touring the downtown area in the evening, a sign of just how safe the young dictator felt. The Singaporean government, meanwhile, was not merely an observer. It held high-level meetings with both presidents, paid for the North Korean accommodation, and released an official logo for the event, promoting its reputation as a trusted, neutral third-party facilitator. This image has been carefully crafted over decades. It also hosts the annual Shangri-La Dialogue and rotating summits of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. In 2015, Singapore was chosen for the no less historic or delicate meeting between Chairman Xi Jinping of the People's Republic of China and then-President of the Republic of China, or Taiwan, Ma Ying-jeou. That event was so sensitive in nature that even the linguistic terms used were carefully scrutinized. Because neither side recognizes the legitimacy of the other, officials negotiated their respective titles in advance. They would be addressed as the Leader of Mainland China and Leader of Taiwan, and refer to each other only as Mr. in Mandarin. Here, too, Singapore is unusual in that it carefully engages both sides of this heated geopolitical divide. Its military has trained with Taiwan since the 70s and is the only Southeast Asian country to share with it a bilateral free trade agreement. Singapore's long-standing, almost default status as a trusted intermediary makes it easy to forget just how unlikely this fact is. Having been forced into independence by its expulsion from the Federation of Malaysia in 1965, the new republic faced several potentially existential threats. At about 700 square kilometers, or 270 square miles, Singapore is about one-fourth the size of Rhode Island, has no large lakes or rivers, is devoid of natural resources, and is now home to around 5.5 million people. Not only is it not predisposed to project global power and relevance, but its small size and close proximity to much larger Malaysia and Indonesia make even its continued existence challenging. And because of its strategic location on the Strait of Malacca, it even faces threats from non-state actors like pirates. These undesirable circumstances impressed on its early government the urgent necessity of making and keeping as many friends as possible. From those early days of independence, Singapore positioned itself as the Switzerland of Asia, engaging with anyone who would accept its friendship. But while Swiss neutrality is deliberately static and unchanging, Singapore attempts to balance the relative influence of its powerful allies, China and the United States. In addition to being its largest source of foreign investment, the US is also a significant military partner. When the American military was ordered to leave the Philippines in the 90s, Singapore allowed it access to its Changi naval base, one of only a few piers in Asia deep enough for US aircraft carriers to dock and resupply. American nuclear submarines, aircraft carrier groups, and spy planes regularly transit through Singapore on their way to conduct freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea. This military cooperation agreement was renewed for the second time in 2020, and in another sign of its strong ties, the US also sold Singapore 12 F-35 fighter jets. But while it engages with the US very closely, it does not do so exclusively. Singapore is careful never to choose sides. For example, it never officially refers to the US as an ally, and uses the term American facilities, not bases. Likewise, it abstains from discussing sensitive issues in China, including its controversial maritime claims. Singapore conducts military training exercises with the People's Liberation Army, and China is its largest trading partner. Realistically, neither China nor the US likely appreciate its close relations with the other, and occasionally attempt to tilt the balance in their favor. When Singapore is tested, however, it almost always remains disciplined in its neutrality. For example, in 2003, it turned down an offer to become an official non-NATO ally to the US. And in 2016, China impounded 9 of its armored military vehicles in Hong Kong on their return journey from training in Taiwan, a clear reminder of its influence. For the most part, both sides appreciate the predictability of this strategy, which has survived 3 Singaporean prime ministers and 10 American presidents, 6 of which were Republican and 4 Democratic. For decades, Singapore has greatly benefited from the economic rise of China, while not being beholden to it thanks to its close military engagement with the US. In not being forced to choose sides, it's benefited from both. But as China has grown in size and influence, deteriorating its relations with the US, Singapore has remained small. The close personal relationship of its founder, Lee Kuan Yew, with China's leadership is no more, and once again it must fight to survive. As the peaceful stability which enabled its prosperity is replaced with more aggressive relations between its 2 non-ally allies, the cost of neutrality will only grow. In other words, one day Singapore may finally be forced to choose a side. But until that day comes, it would like for both sides to fear the outcome. Singapore's natural dependence on other countries has led it to pursue some unusual policies to ensure its security. For example, the Singaporean government has convinced its population to drink pee. Humorous as that sounds, it's absolutely not a joke. To find out what drinking pee has to do with Singapore's national security, you can watch the extended version of this video which replaces this ad on our new streaming platform, Nebula. While these videos will continue being available here, there are some topics and tangents, like drinking pee, that aren't quite right for YouTube, but I just can't not mention. If you enjoy these videos, the best way to watch them is before they're posted on YouTube, without ads, and with specially made bonus content from your favorite creators like Wendover Productions, Real Engineering, and Real Life Lore on Nebula. But it gets better, because we've partnered with CuriosityStream, where you can watch documentaries like Singapore's Field of Dreams, which explains how the city built a stadium which can adapt to hold over 30 different sports, and The Rise of the Gulf, about the growth of oil cities like Dubai. You can get CuriosityStream and Nebula for the very affordable price of just $15 a year. In other words, you get access to thousands of great documentaries, you get ad-free, early, and bonus content, you help support creators like myself, and right now it's 26% off. It would be a crime not to take advantage of this deal. Sign up with the link in the description, and you'll get an email shortly afterward with access to Nebula.